bump and change in location, but I think this is gonna work out fine. We did wait a little bit to help some of the people that had to take a detour to get here. Our program today is about the Adventist engagement with nature, from birding to conservation, presented by Dr. Jim Hayward from the biology department here. As we begin, Dr. Rowland's going to offer a word of prayer.
Father in heaven, thank you for the opportunity of gathering together. We ask that you will bless our association, guide and direct, for we ask in Jesus' name.
Our next forum meeting is scheduled for January 22. It's Dr. John Walton from Wheaton College, professor of Old Testament there. And some of you have probably read his recent book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, Ancient Cosmology and the Origins Debate. I think you'll find that interesting. Then on February 26, Dr. Chuck Scriven, president of Kettering College and the board chairman of the Association of Adventist Forums, can be with us presenting the program on the promise of peace. In March, we're still a little bit negotiating on the date, but the plan is to have Elder Rebecca Liu, a Adventist ordained minister from China, who will be here speaking to us about issues related to women ministry, the Adventist Church in China. And then on April 9, Michael Schofield, a consultant from Loma Linda, California, will be with us to discuss Adventist higher education in North America. Which school should we close first? I don't think Andrews is on the short list. Anyway, just to be sure, you might want to come. If you would like to, if you're not getting email notifications, would like to, there's a sign-up sheet in the back on both sides. And if you're not a regular contributor to Adventist Forums and would like to be, there's some envelopes back there that you can take and send in your tax-deductible contribution if you would so want to. Again, we appreciate the behind-the-scenes work that Debbie and Terry do to get out the information and publicity on our programs. Well, as mentioned, our program today is From Birding to Conservation, Adventist Engagement with Nature. It's presented by Dr. Jim Hayward, who probably most of you know, but just in case you don't, I'll tell you a little bit about him. He received his PhD in zoology from Washington State University, and currently teaches in the areas of ecology, origins, speciation, research methods, and bioethics here at Andrews. Before coming here, he taught at Southwestern, at Walla Walla, and at Union Colleges. He spends his summers at Protection Island National Wildlife Refuge in Washington State, studying gulls. Now, when you first hear phrases like federal protection, island refuge, maybe you think he's a participant in some sort of safe house location for the federal witness protection program. Maybe it calls up, you know, ideas of the Birdman of Alcatraz.
You weren't supposed to announce that.
actually, this is kind of an ecological treasure there, where there are nesting sites for thousands of birds, and it's a kind of a sensitive site, and you have to have special permission to go there, even though it's a national wildlife refuge. If you look up on their website, you know, it tells you how to get there, but says this isn't open to the public. But it does mention that I think they refer it through Walla Walla College, has permission to be there and do research. Anyway, Jim studies communication and the habitat selection and the reproductive success of gulls, and this has been a study going on for many years. In fact, he is co-director of a multidisciplinary team on seabird ecology, and one of the things they do, besides making meticulous counts and measurements and so on, then they develop mathematical models to try to predict or describe behavior of the various marine animals. But just in case you think that's all he does, the other end of the spectrum, he studies fossilization of dinosaur eggs. So, and his research has been funded by various organizations, including the National Science Foundation. Obviously, he's published a lot of articles in refereed scientific journals. For the forum crowd, I'd mention he's also edited the book Creation Reconsidered, that is published by the forums and is based on presentations at a geology study trip some years back. And this makes quite interesting reading. So, Jim, the time's yours. We appreciate you being here.
Sorry, Gary. Thank you, Art. It's fun to be here, and it's fun to talk to you about my favorite topic, which is nature. And so that's what I want to talk to you about today. And we'll talk to you a little bit about, Art was telling you I work at Protection Island National Wildlife Refuge with Shondell and a lot of students. And that's what I want to talk about initially here, at least. This is the island. It doesn't look too spectacular from the water. But we think it's a spectacular place. And I'm just going to run through some slides here. Here is the entrance sign. Not too many people get to see this because the island, as Art said, is closed to the public. But we think it's a fantastic place. This little this picture shows where we live. We live in that cabin up there every summer for about 3 months. And we don't have electricity. We do have running water. We have a gas refrigerator. We are very quite comfortable out there. And we don't have a lot of disturbance from intruders. The caretaker comes by once in a while. That's about it. It's a beautiful place to work. Everywhere we look, about every side of the cabin that we look from, we see beauty. This is going out the door of the cabin. This is looking out the back of the cabin. This is, again, looking out the side of the cabin, beautiful cloud formations there. We have incredible scenery. This is the spit where we do much of our work. And this is Mount Baker, which we see from the place where we do a lot of our observations. A lot of fog out there. It's the Pacific Northwest, after all. And here we see Finger Pier. We see a lot of cormorants out there in the pier. We look at more than scenery here. We're really interested in the birds. We appreciate the scenery a lot, but we're really out there for the science, at least in part, as I'm going to tell you. And we're interested in what these animals do and how they interact with each other and how they interact with their environment. So that's what we really focus on there. But it's still beautiful, and we do appreciate that. This is the animal that we spend most of our time on. This is the glaucous winged gull, and we think it's a beautiful bird. It's a large gull. It's about the size of the herring gulls around here, except sleeker, with a little longer wings. And we watch how they interact, how they defend their territories, how they make love with one another, and how they produce babies. And the babies are just darling. As you can see here. And the parents are very protective of their young. Did I just skip something? No. OK. We also are interested in the bald eagles. We have a lot of bald eagles on the island. In the summer, we have one nesting pair that produces young on the island. But we have a lot of visitors in the summer. We've counted up to 38 in one spot. And then going around the island, we've sometimes seen up to 50 or more bald eagles on the island. A lot of young eagles. This has been a very good time for eagles the last 10 years. And that has been of great interest to us. And how they interact with the other birds on the island. Here's a young eagle, first year eagle, feeding up in a tree. They look kind of goofy. You ever? I think it was Ben Franklin who said we should have used the turkey for our national bird. And we watch these eagles, and we kind of agree with him sometimes. We like to consider the interactions between eagles and the other animals, and one of them, one of the most dramatic is between the gulls and the eagles. Here you see a gull pulling the tail feather out of a juvenile eagle, and they do that commonly, actually. We also are interested in the harbor seals, and we have 500, 600, 700 harbor seals, and they pup there on the island, and that is just fascinating to watch. We have tufted puffins that nest on the island. They're our most dramatic and beautiful bird, I guess you could say, stunning in terms of that orange bill. We also have quite a large herd of deer on the island, and black oyster catchers. It's just an amazing place. Little chipmunks, Townsend chipmunks, and of course the ubiquitous crows, which we also like out there. Pigeon guillemots, which are a little alcid. Killdeer, and people. And we don't just watch these animals. We actually work very hard out there. In fact, some people think we go out and we kind of lounge around on the beach all summer. We don't. Libby back here works with us, and she knows we don't ever get on the beach during the summer. It's nonstop. We start early in the morning, and we're going until dark. And I go probably 4 or 5 summers before I even get on the beach sometimes. It's really a lot of work, but it's a great deal of fun. This is a rhinoceros auklet, and we have 70,000 of these birds living on Protection Island. This is why the refuge was set aside. This is the only refuge that was set aside during Ronald Reagan's administration. I won't say any more about that, but you understand. this is one of the wildlife biologists working on the pigeon guillemots. And this is one of our helpers out there. She does auto mechanics as well as mathematics. And we're very pleased about that. Takes a lot of time to keep our equipment running. We have a lot of electronic equipment, cameras, camera controllers, vehicles, all kinds of things. And we spend a lot of time with that. We also spend a tremendous amount of time hauling stuff from the mainland. We have to haul all our drinking water, all our food, everything we use out there we have to haul. And so we make a town trip once a week, load up on food, and these kids eat a lot. and some of them drink a lot. We have, is Andre here? Andre Moncrief. Okay. Andre's not here. Andre drinks a huge amount of water, and we like to tease him about that. Here we see Andre and Libby and Brianna not this summer, but I think the last summer, and they worked very hard there in the colony. We could not do our work without their help, I can guarantee you that. I don't know if we should tell them what you were doing here. They were collecting fecal samples, gull fecal samples. And this is all the, Art's fault here, because he made a suggestion at one meeting that Shondell was presenting at. And he said, you ought to collect fecal samples, see if you can get hormone signals on those. And we did get hormone signals. So that's, in fact, why we have our new grant, is because of Art. So we're very pleased for that information. Shondell spends a lot of time on the computer. I'm more the data collection guy, and she's the data cruncher guy, gal. Sorry. We got a lot of rain out there. It's an unusual kind of rain, but it's interesting. We do spend a lot of time, as I said, up until evening many times, recording our data, transcribing our data. And again, no electricity out there, which is just fine with me. We love the gas lamp. It gives a nice warm glow, and it's just very pleasant place to work. Well, let me back up there and just stop for a second and say that when I'm out on Protection Island, there are two sides of me operating. One is the scientist side, and I want to read an excerpt from a paper that we've just written, not because I think you think it's interesting, but because I want to contrast it with something else. Okay, Maximum numbers of bald eagles visible per day on Violet Point from 1993 to 2002 range from 8 in 1994 to 26 in 1999. Subadults outnumbered adults during all years. The observed ratio of adults to subadults to adults peaked at 4.33 in 1997, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, this is a technical paper. Notice the words are clean-shaven, they're objective, they're unambiguous, they're rational, they're scientific. This is the other side of me. And this is the side I want to talk to you about tonight, or today. And this was an article that I did in Spectrum here a few years ago. The creatures teach me uncensored things about life. The sea teaches me about contingency and vitality. The night sky teaches me about creation and eternity. No pretense here. Life and death occupy two sides of a razor-thin reality. Comedy and tragedy define existence and mold the passage of time. Born of water and ice, the island's endless story merges with my own. Annie Dillard writes that when we die, the last thing on our minds is a register, is the dreaming memory of land as it lay this way and that. For me, this will be Protection Island. This is the part of me that I want to talk about today. It is the spiritual side. Here, the words are subjective, they're ambiguous, they're intuitive, they're emotive, they're mystical. And this is a part of me that is working kind of at the same time as the scientific part. And it's really the part that I love the most. I love the science, but it's the other part of me that is the most interesting. I was interested in animals as far as I can remember. Here I am with my little brother in 1956 with a couple of cats. We have sort of a ministry of cats in our family. It goes back to my dad and my grandfather, all of whom like cats, and we still love those animals. I became interested in birding at about age 7, started keeping a life list. Here I am with some friends birding, and I began to do a little more sort of scientific things, I guess, when I was in college, collecting mammals, a collection, and today I continue to be interested in both the science and the more, I suppose, mystical side of nature. As I look around, I think about that, and I wonder, why was I influenced in that way? What was it that stimulated my interest? Well, I had two heroes back when I was a kid. Most kids, most boys at least, have heroes like, back in my time, it was Ted Williams and Roger Maris and people like that. I hardly knew what those people were or what they did. I was interested in people like Ernest Booth. Ernest Booth, if you knew anything about him, he was the professor of biology at Walla Walla College. He started the Marine Station at Rosario Beach. He was a real character. And he wrote a lot of books, a lot of articles, which I had read. He edited The Naturalist, which was a little magazine that I subscribed to. He wrote the biology book for my high school, Biology, the Story of Life. That book inspired me. And I wrote Ernest back in 1963, and I said, I really am interested in mammals. I want to become a mammalologist. I'm having a hard time collecting mammals, and I wonder if you could help me. Well, as fate would be, he said, well, actually, I'm going to come through Fort Worth here in a few weeks. Would you like me to present at your church? I don't know who's in charge of your church, but maybe they'd let me come and talk. Well, my dad was the pastor of the church, so we had him talk. And not only that, he stayed in our house, which I thought, here's one of my heroes staying with us. And he took me out and showed me, where to look for trackways and this kind of thing. And Ernest was a great influence on me as a young kid. The other person who was even a greater influence was Sam Campbell. Sam Campbell, I don't know how to describe Sam Campbell's influence on me, but it was tremendous. I have such great enthusiasm for his books, still do. I can still quote parts of his books because I read them over and over and over again. When I got sick, it was Sam Campbell's books that I read and got me interested in nature. Sam Campbell was a Christian Scientist, and he was yet in very much involved in Adventism here, or at least the Adventist community. Here he is in about 1958, about 4 years before he died, here at Andrews University. He was at his 20th consecutive annual presentation at Andrews University as a Lyceum program. So he became well known here in the Midwest for his nature talks and so on. Well, Sam was a great influence on me, and I see that Ernest was sort of the science influence, whereas Sam was more of the spiritual, maybe mystical influence. Here's a few of his books that he wrote. Maybe how many of you have read Sam Campbell's books? Oh my goodness! All right, yes, I'm with friends here. This is good. So you know what I'm talking about. We're of a certain age, that's right. The braying of the forum, that's what they talk about, that's right. So here's a wonderful quote from Sam. The forest, he's talking about when he first comes to this forest he's never seen before. He says, the forest exceeded anything I had pictured in my dreams. It was ancient, immense, mysterious, captivating. I felt as if there were an all-pervading force encompassing it. This I named the spirit of the wilderness, referring to the unbroken primitive atmosphere. He often talks or writes about the spirit of the wilderness in his books. Well, I'm still split between these two worlds. I do science. One part of me does the science. Another part of me does the sort of naturalist thing. And I'm very happy that I have both those components. I think a person would have a very one-dimensional life if they were just involved in science, or two-dimensional life, whatever you want to say. Wouldn't have that depth that we have otherwise. But I thought there are many, many people. I'm not the only one, certainly. There are many of you are also interested in nature, or you probably wouldn't be here with the title that we had. I've wondered sometimes why did I develop that interest? What have other people found interesting about it? And what other people in Adventism have been interested in nature? So I'd like to sort of go through that just very briefly here and give you just a little survey of that. Here's one person, Jim Tucker. Some of you know Jim. He taught here for a number of years in the School of Education. Jim Tucker was a teacher at Forest Lake Academy when I first heard of him. A couple of friends of mine who I grew up with in the South had gone to Forest Lake, and they wrote me about this incredible birder that they had as a biology teacher. Well, Jim then went to the University of Texas, where he got his doctorate, and while there, he decided to start a birding club. Most of the bird organizations, like the Audubon Society, had gone more into conservation work, and he was interested in the competitive side of birding. And so he said, let's start, and he wasn't against conservation, but he just wanted to have some way of communicating with other people interested in listing birds and so on. And so he started this birding organization. They had about 12 people involved. And he sent a little newsletter around, and that was the first publication of his organization. And today that has grown to the American Birding Association, it has tens of thousands of members and is a very successful magazine, Birding. Jim, of course, also published Windows on God's World, which was a very popular devotional back in the 1970s. You may remember that. He is now McKee Professor for Excellence in Learning at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. That's what he's doing now. Floyd Murdoch. Murdoch's a good name around Andrews University. Ruth Murdoch is Floyd's mother. And Floyd's father was the dean of the seminary, Elder Murdoch, Dr. Murdoch. And Floyd has the distinction of being at least 1 year he had seen more birds in North America than any other person in North America. He was obsessed. He is obsessed by birds, I should say. And I asked him to send me a couple of pictures, and he did. He sent me several, and these are the two that I'm showing here. He looks like he picked up a roadkill here. He has quite a museum that he runs in Maryland, I believe it is, right now. He lives out in the east. He's been very active in birding and conservation work. He was president of the Audubon Naturalist Society in Washington, D.C. area. He was also president of the Speakers Bureau at Smithsonian Institution. Here he is giving an award to the president or past president of the Nature Conservancy at a ceremony at Smithsonian. So Floyd has been deeply involved in the sort of naturalist movement within the church. He is by training a historian, but his dissertation was For the Birds, a History of Bird Protection in the United States. So that was his thesis. He combined his passions of history and birding in that one dissertation. Another individual you may or may not have heard of, if you're a birding freak, you probably have heard of Benton Basham. And Basham is one of those legendary birders. He's from Chattanooga or Collegedale, Tennessee. And here he is in the middle here, birding with none other than Roger Torrey Peterson, the Peterson Guide. So quite well known.
Which one is Peterson?
Well, Peterson's the one on the right. He's quite aged there. He died quite a number of years ago now. Kevin Easley. Kevin was a student at Andrews University, and for a time at least, and actually birded with his dad many, many years ago in Texas. And this is Kevin, runs a birding organization in Costa Rica today. This is Floyd Hayes. He's a professor at Pacific Union College. An expert on the birds of the Caribbean, has written extensively about that in papers as well as books, and very active involved in that sort of thing. C. Roy Smith, who many of you knew here at Andrews University. C. Roy was legendary in this community for his birding enthusiasm and the impact he had on young people here at the academy and elsewhere. It was a terrible loss when he passed away. Currently, Gordon Atkins, who many of you know. Gordon is an avid birder. Along with being a neurobiologist, he's very much involved in birding. In fact, right now he's down looking at sandhill cranes at Jasper Pulaski. He told me he would just hated being missing this, but I told him he was doing better things than sitting here. Dennis Woodland, who is my next door neighbor in the office, at least here, and Dennis has been extremely involved in the local community and in the region in conservation work. And I'm very impressed with his level of commitment to the environment. Here you see him with students in various activities, including cleaning up Highway 31. He's just a bundle of energy. Some others that you probably haven't heard about. Bill Fritz. Bill Fritz was a student at Walla Walla College when I was getting my doctorate at Washington State. And he was a kid who just didn't seem to have any direction. He didn't know where he was going, what he was doing. He was a biology major. But one of the faculty there, Lanny Fisk, took an interest in Bill and said, you know, this guy's got something going. He believed in him. And Bill is now senior vice president for academic affairs at the College of Staten Island. He's a geologist and has a PhD from the University of Montana, worked with Gulf Oil, or one of the oil companies, for a time, and he has published this book, Roadside Geology of Yellowstone Country, which if you go to Yellowstone, it's the book to get for understanding the geology. Another person, Kirk Johnson. I think Art is the one that told me about Kirk Johnson. He's vice president for research and collections, Denver Museum of Nature and Science. Just published this book called Cruising the Fossil Freeway. Kirk grew up in Washington State. I don't know him personally, but his book looks kind of interesting. Again, from an Adventist background, moving into sort of an area where he's enthusiastic and probably encouraging kids to get involved in nature. Chris Haney, graduate of Southern University, Southern Adventist University, wonderful guy, gentle, spirited person. He's chief scientist and vice president for science at Defenders of the Wildlife, a major organization in Washington, D.C. And he is a world's expert on offshore birding, or offshore birds, I should say. Published a great deal in that area. Pamela Rasmussen worked on Protection Island, actually. She's was Joe Galusha's master's student. She went on to get her PhD at the University of Kansas. She's now a fellow of the American Ornithologists Union. She's an assistant curator of mammalogy and ornithology at Michigan State University. Pam is well known in the ornithological community for her rediscovery of the forest owlet, which hadn't been seen in 113 years in India. And she rediscovered it. And she's also the lead author on the birds of South Asia, which is a two-volume set, and has really made a huge impact. She's a really relatively young person and has really gone places. Again, start with an Adventism. Bobby Harrison, person who's today associated with the alleged rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And he's quite sure he saw it. Some other people aren't quite so sure. I'm not sure who's right. Steve Dunbar, Loma Linda University, runs an organization for the protection of turtles off the shore of Honduras. Devin Graham, another graduate of Walla Walla College, now Walla Walla University. I'm used to saying Walla Walla College. It's my old alma mater. Devin is president and scientific director of Project Amazonas, which is an NGO that works out of Peru. He's also an expert on the birds of Peru and does birding trips down there. If you want a great birding trip, contact Devin Graham. And finally, Merlin Tuttle. Merlin was a graduate of Andrews University, and he is founder and president of the Bat Conservation International. And you've probably seen his pictures in National Geographic and elsewhere. He is well known for his work in that area. I have to let you know that one of the best known to me conservationists is a young lady from whom I got this brochure, and I've got to read this for you. It's just precious. This is from an 8-year-old. We need food. We need land. We need paper. We need trees. We need milk, wool, and etc. We need the country. This is a plea from the Band of Mercy and the Junior Rodeo Association. Our country is going fast. We must have land, trees, and the country for correct living. We must learn to live without more and more modern things. Please keep America clean, beautiful, and help keep her producing her products. Thanks. Soil eroding, plant trees. Then one and two. It says, look at one and two. So you look at one, it's a TV. Two, a horse. Which better builds the mind? And then your body needs exercise. And if you can see who did this, it's Shondell Henson. Please think hard about it. She's a delight. I dedicate this talk to her because she's the one that suggested it and is a real stimulus, especially for exercise. All right, so a lot of Adventists have been very interested in the nature study and the interested in nature. And I'd like to just briefly run through why I think that may be the case, some influences as to how people have been interested in this particular topic. Ellen White has been behind a lot of this. And this is a quote that talks about country living. And I think the agrarian and small town roots of Adventists has played a large role in our interest in nature. To many of those living in the cities who have not a spot of green grass to set their feet upon, who year after year have looked out upon filthy courts and narrow alleys, brick walls and pavements, and skies clouded with dust and smoke, if these could be taken to some farming district, surrounded with green fields, the woods and hills and brooks and clear skies In the fresh, pure air of the country, it would seem almost like heaven. Ellen White. Indeed, Adventism is a rural, small town movement. Think of the small towns that are famous sort of amongst Adventists. Battle Creek, Michigan, Santa Elena, California, Berrien Springs, Michigan, South Lancaster, Massachusetts, Collegedale, Tennessee, Keene, Texas, Angwin, California, College Place, Washington. All these relatively small places, or at least they used to be. Some of them have grown a little bit larger more recently. Some of the early Adventists were very close to nature. William Miller was a farmer. Hiram Edson was a farmer. Joseph Bates was a sea captain. All of these people, close to the sea, close to the earth, they were in communion, in a sense, with nature. So I think that was an influence. Many of Adventist schools have agriculture programs or farms in which where the students worked, where things were grown. People stayed close to the land, close to the natural world. Back when I was about 6 years old, this gentleman came and talked at our church in Providence, Rhode Island. This is Henry White. He is Ellen White's grandson. Henry took us out into a field, one of the parishioners' farms, and he showed us what he talked about as grandma's dressing. And that was a special compost that Ellen White had developed herself and used to plant fruit trees. And he showed us how Ellen White planted a fruit tree. I still remember that from those many years ago. And here is what she writes about that here. I ordered my hired man, I guess she didn't do it herself. She had hired people to do these things. I ordered my hired man to dig a deep cavity in the ground, then put in rich dirt, then stones, then rich dirt. After this, he put in layers of earth and dressing until the hole was filled. Our crops were very successful. The peaches were the most beautiful in coloring, the most delicious in flavor of any that I had tasted. So Ellen was interested in agriculture. Again, a strong influence here. The rural camp meeting tradition. How many of you have gone to camp meeting? Okay, everybody, just about everybody's gone. How many of you have lived and attended camp meeting? Okay, yeah, that was a great thing when I was a kid. You went to camp meeting and you lived in a tent, and here's the old Methodist camp meeting in 1819. Did they start the camp meetings, Gary, or was this a Methodist? Yeah, the Methodists did that. You see the tents there in the background. Here's Ellen White at a Hornetsville, New York camp meeting in about 1880, and here's three of my cousins at camp meeting in Southern England Conference in South Lancaster in 1954. And I remember those days fondly, living in those tents, smelling the canvas. And then Dad was involved in Camp Strike and Camp Pitch, and we got to ride around the trucks, and that was just a great blast. A second influence here, God's second book. Nature is God's second book. And as Ellen White says in the very first sentence of Steps to Christ, nature and revelation alike testify of God's love. Ellen White took her own words seriously here. She loved to go out on carriage rides here with Sarah McIntyre. Is that how you say it?
McIntyre.
Okay, thank you. I won't try to say that. Anyway, it was her right-hand assistant, and here she looks like she's getting elderly, but she loved to go out in these carriage rides in the country and be inspired by the natural world. As a kid, I was inspired by pictures in the Bible story. This one particularly was impressive to me. I don't know how many times, hundreds of times, I probably looked at this picture, even tried to draw it at times, and it always seemed so inspiring to me. Here's Adam with all the animals, naming the animals, and that was just an amazing thing to me. He looked so happy and so healthy, and that was just a neat thing. Harry Berg, our own Carol Bernese's father, was the artist for many, many nature books, especially those by Ernest Booth. Harry Berg's Nature Stories and the Junior Guide inspired a lot of kids to get interested in nature. The Pathfinders, there are 75 honors in nature. And the Pathfinders. Now, you may not think that's really that impressive, but compare that to the Boy Scouts of America. there are only 21 merit badges involved in nature. To me, this says something about the emphasis in Adventism about nature. Adventists have been very seriously involved in nature study for a long time. Family guide to Sabbath nature activities. We've been encouraged to do nature activities in the Sabbath hours. Thirdly, natural health and healing. Ellen White says the sick need to be brought into close touch with nature and outdoor life amid natural surroundings would work wonders for many a helpless and almost hopeless invalid. Pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise, proper diet, the use of water, trust in divine power, these are the true remedies, says Ellen White. Here was her most ardent follower back in the mid-19th century. This is none other than John Harvey Kellogg, a young picture of him with his wife and three of his adopted children. And Kellogg referred to Ellen White's principles as biologic living. And according to Kellogg, biologic living means health, comfort, efficiency, and long life. So a little tour of his interests here. Here are the seven vivacious little vegetarians. These were part of his third race betterment conference at Battle Creek. He kind of dabbled in eugenics, actually. And these little children apparently performed at the third race betterment conference. And clearly vegetarian, excuse me. Of course, he was a strong proponent of vegetarian diet. He was also a proponent of exercise. And he and Shondell would have got along very well together. Water. I love this picture. Water was important. They did everything possible with water. Things unimaginable with water. Sunlight, both artificial and real. And of course, he was very much against tobacco and alcohol, things like that. And rest. Rest was an important component of his understanding of the importance of life. These are just precious. Breathing exercises. Everybody breathing. If you go on YouTube, you can see a little short clip of the breathing exercises on the movie Journey to Wellville. I don't know if it's kind of a nasty movie, but it's interesting. There, women are out there, you know, singing as they're doing their breathing exercises. And trust in divine power. These are the nurses at chapel exercise at Easter morning at the sanitarium. Today, many of the so-called independent Adventist ministries are promoting the same types of things that Ellen White promoted and John Harvey Kellogg promoted. Wildwood, Eden Valley, Uchi Pines, Black Hills Health and Education Center, and the Heartland Institute. Weimar has taken this to even a new level, and they show the symbols here, proper diet, exercise, water, sunlight, abstemiousness, fresh air, rest, trust. These were the things that Ellen White talked about. They've just turned the words into nutrition, exercise, water, sunlight, temperance, and the New Start program, and that's been a very popular program. Fourthly, flight to the mountains. This is maybe a minor influence, but nonetheless, I think it may have influenced Adventist people. The people of God will flee from the cities and villages and associate together in companies dwelling in the most desolate and solitary places. Many will find refuge in the strongholds of the mountains. Harold Drake, who's a professor of biology at Atlantic Union College, wrote this little book, which I have, called Common Edible Wild Plants. Let's look at the first page of that book. Present world conditions indicate that we may find it necessary to resort to such emergency food. When could be a better time to learn about such things than at the present? So encouragement to think about the natural world. Here's one. If you want to pay $279, there's still time. December 12th to 19th, 2010, Wildwood Health Resort. You can learn about country living in the last days and learn how to make bread and soy milk and canning and plumb a toilet, actually. And that seems to be one of their primary things right up there, is plumbing a toilet. I'm not exactly sure why that is the case, but I probably would have put bread up there, but they put a toilet. Here's a young person. I always look forward to fleeing to the mountains. This is a new take on fleeing to the mountains. Always look forward to fleeing to the mountains. Camping, hiking. I can hardly read this, it's so funny. Camping, hiking, eating wild edible plants. It was particularly important to learn your plants so you wouldn't have to kill animals and eat meat. I couldn't get my parents to go camping, so I looked forward to the time of the end when we have to camp. She's a dear, I tell you. She is so inspiring. Then finally, creation and the Sabbath. I'm still laughing. I just can't get over that one. In Eden, God set up the memorial of his work of creation and placing his blessing upon the seventh day. Certainly, Adventists have thought of creation and the Sabbath as being very united in their minds. Here, we see a depiction of God at rest on the seventh day, resting after the creation he had made. A number of Adventists have been influenced by what he made, perhaps even more than the fact that he made it. And there's been a strong interest in not just the Rock of Ages, but the ages of rocks. And so if you've been had your ear to the ground here lately, you've heard a lot about that. Well, where did that come from? Well, originally, of course, from Ellen White, because she makes some very direct statements about that. But it probably wouldn't have been a big a deal in our church if it hadn't been for this gentleman, George McCready Price. Next door, I have an office in Price Hall, George McCready Price Hall. Price was an interesting character. I wish I had known him. He's the father of the modern creationist movement, no question about that. He inspired many Adventists to go into science and to think about nature. And I think for that reason, we need to honor sort of his memory for that reason. He was a prolific author, over 20 books and hundreds of articles that he wrote, both inside the church and without. Here are just a few of his books. Martin Gardner called him the last and the greatest of the anti-evolutionists. A variety of people followed in his wake, I guess we could say. Harold W. Clark, PUC, Frank Marsh, who was first director of Geoscience Research Institute, Robert Brown, also a director of GRI, Ariel Roth, also a director of GRI, and once the chair of our biology department here at Andrews. Dick Ritland, our good friend here and neighbor, was also a director of Geoscience Research Institute. Ed Hare was with Geoscience for a short time and then moved to Carnegie Institute, where he had a very successful career. Harold Coffin was long time teaching at Walla Walla College and also at Geoscience Research Institute. Harold James, with us today, was involved in this conversation, as well as Leonard Brand and Elaine Kennedy. All of these people were involved in the conversation about the past. What was the past like? And I would say probably not one of those people agreed with any of the others. That's just the way it is. And that's good. That's healthy. That keeps us thinking about important things. This is just a small sampling of the books that have come out in our denomination about Earth history. Price's most famous book is The New Geology. Price was not exactly humble about his ideas, I have to say. He called this the Great Law of Conformable Stratigraphic Sequence. Now, if you're not a geologist, this may not make a whole lot of sense to you, but just listen for a second. By all odds, the most important law ever formulated with reference to the order and the strata in water order in which the strata occur. And this is his law. Any kind of fossiliferous beds, whatever, young or old, may be found occurring conformably on any other fossiliferous beds, older or younger. Well, in just a few years, in fact, just about 10 years later or so, his former student, Harold W. Clark, said, after studying this and going into the field, no, it's not true. There is order to the fossil record. And he put forth this notion, which is called the ecological zonation theory, overturned Price's views, and Price actually came unglued and wrote this diatribe against Clark called Theories of Satanic Origin. You thought things were getting hot today. The things were very hot back then. He filed formal heresy charges against Clark, his former student and friend, and fortunately the church had the wisdom to realize that maybe we needed a little diversity in this view, and they tried to placate poor old Price. Lots of different views. When was the flood? Here's a whole bunch of different models that have been presented as to where the flood exists in the geologic column. All of these people had different ideas as to where that occurred, when that occurred. Very dramatically different. If you know anything about the geologic column, these are revolutionary. Okay, very different. Where were the dinosaurs found in the geologic column? Harold Coffin thought it was between the fall and the flood. Frank Marsh thought it was between creation and sometime after the flood. Jack Provancha thought they were around before the creation because Satan had invented them. So all this diversity within Adventism, tremendous, tremendous diversity of thought. Today we have the Geoscience Research Institute, which resides in this beautiful building at Loma Linda University. And they are very active in thinking about these issues. The Review and Herald, or the Adventist Review, I'm still back in the old name here, have spent quite a bit of time talking about this issue. And I'd just like to suggest that nobody sees these issues the same way. We're all looking at things differently. And I think that's probably a good, healthy thing. Okay, I got to quit here in just a few minutes here. Quickly, the historical context. I think Adventism itself grew out of a historical context. So I'd like to look at that just for a few minutes here. 19th century influences on Adventist views, the health reform movement, transcendentalist movement, science and religion dialogue, and the nature study movement, all during the 19th century. Quickly, let's go through that. Health reform movement. Here's some of the famous health reformers of the 19th century and late 18th century. Samuel Thompson, who had the Thompsonian system of medicine, which involved basically using laxative and purgatives to clean out your digestive tract. John Harvey Kellogg, I think, must have been an acolyte of him. He liked to do that too. Sylvester Graham, who's best known for Graham bread, of course. Larkin Coles, who was influential as well. William Alcott, Russell Trawell, Diocletian Lewis, Horace Fletcher. I love Fletcher. Do you chew your food 32 times? Fletcher wanted you to do that. If you didn't, said nature will castigate. Let's see, how did he put it here? I've got it written down here. I can't remember. Nature will castigate those who don't masticate. There's some real beauts back there. And then James C. Jackson. Jackson ran the Home on the Hill, a water cure establishment. Ellen White brought her family there for treatment as well. Transcendentalist movement, perhaps a long way from Adventism in some ways, and yet the Transcendentalists were, here Emerson and Thoreau, I'm sorry, Shondell told me it's Thoreau, yes. Thoreau, were probably the two most famous of the Transcendentalists. Transcendentalism was in part sort of a reaction to the rationalism at Harvard University, and looked at life from a more internalist sort of position. And of course, you know the story of Thoreau in his experience in Walden. Emerson was a beautiful writer, a strong influence on Sam Campbell, by the way. Sam read a lot of Emerson. Here's a couple quotes that I think are quite interesting. In the woods is perpetual youth with these plantations of God, a decorum and sanctity reign, a perennial festival is dressed, and the guest sees not how he should tire of them in 1,000 years. In the woods we return to faith and reason, to the body and mind which have been cramped by noxious work or company. What does that sound like?
Yeah.
Nature is medicinal and restores their tone. Okay? That could have come right out of Ministry of Healing. Here's Ellen White. A mysterious life pervades all nature, a life that sustains unnumbered worlds throughout immensity, that lives in the insect atom, which floats in the summer breeze, that wings the flight of the swallow and feeds the young ravens which cry, that brings the bud to blossom and the flower to fruit. Maybe a hint there of influence. Obviously, transcendentalism was centered in the Northeast. This is where our movement got its start. It's undoubtedly some connection there, at least in a peripheral sense. This is an important aspect, I think, the nature study movement. This was a major movement in the late 19th, early 20th century. Louis Agassiz, who was the famous Swiss geologist and zoologist at Harvard University, said, study nature, not books. And that became the mantra of the nature study movement, which actually got its start in the 1890s. Wilbur Jackman, University of Chicago and Chicago School District, adapt nature study to the nature of the child, base nature study on observation, and use nature study as a basis for expression in the child. Very much interested in bringing the natural world to children. To the east of us, at Cornell University, Liberty Hyde Bailey. I love these names. How would you like to be called Liberty Hyde Bailey? Nature study is not science. It is not knowledge. It is not facts. It is spirit. That's at Cornell University. And Bailey was part of the nature study department at Cornell University. The nature study department. That was different than the zoology department and all the others. It was a special nature study department. There were nature clubs that developed over the East from based at Cornell. Nature study books came out. Notice the dates here, 1892 to 2005. And notice when the book Education came out, it's not the next one, is 1903. So right in that time, and if you read book Education, there's a lot in there about the natural world and the importance of that to children. The most famous of these nature study people was Anna Comstock. And Anna Comstock wrote this Handbook of Nature Study, which is still in print, and talks a lot about how to do nature activities with children. Homeschool business or industry is actually using this a lot in homeschool study. Nature study is for the comprehension of the individual life of the bird, insect, or plant that is nearest at hand, says Anna Comstock. Again, a professor along with her husband at Cornell University. Interesting comparison here. Here's Ellen White in the book Education in 1903. Minds that have been amused and abused by reading fiction may in nature have an open book and read truth in the works of God and around them. All may find themes of study in the simple beauties of nature in perfect order and harmony, controlled by infinite power. Here are subjects for which called deep thought and for the stretch of the imagination. Here's Anna Comstock. Nature study cultivates the child's imagination, since there are so many wonderful and true stories that he may read with his own eyes, which affect his imagination as much as does fairy lore. At the same time, nature study cultivates in him a perception and regard for what is true and the power to express it. Nature study gives the child practical and helpful knowledge. I think a really interesting relationship there. I don't think Anna Comstock read Ellen White, but it's just telling us something about the the spirit of the times is certainly there in both of those people. Okay, quickly, the science-faith dialogue. A variety of people here, I won't go through all of them. They were all involved in science and faith type issues. You remember the names probably, William Paley, George Cuvier, William Buckland, Charles Hodge, a theologian at Princeton, Louis Agassiz, Charles Darwin, Asa Gray, and Philip Henry Gossi. I'd like to talk more about those, but I don't have time. Very quickly, some objections to nature study. Yes, there are some, or at least the conservation movement. Let's quickly go through some of those. Here's a former Adventist, Constance Cumby, a fundamentalist attorney from Michigan. She says, where fundamentalists and New Agers alike are harmonically converging is clearly in the direction of earth worship and beyond to universe cosmos adoration. So she's very much down on, of course, environmentalism, and feels like this is leading us down the wrong path. Poster. And this is something we hear from our students when we try to talk about conservation. Global warming, rejoice. Droughts, floods, ecological disaster, signs of Jesus' return. Praise God.
Bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on, that's right. So this is an attitude that this is not within Adventism, but nonetheless, this is the attitude that we hear frequently from our students. It's very hard to get Adventist students involved in conservation issues or environmental issues because I think they are thinking these sorts of ideas many times. Here's another one. This is a blogger. Certainly not representative of all conservatives at all here, but rule the earth perspective. Environmentalists also like to attack automobiles. They claim that before automobiles and factories, the environment was pristine. This is simply not true. 90% of the world's cars are in the northern hemisphere, and yet there is no hemispheric difference in carbon monoxide levels. Fact is that carbon monoxide is produced by living things, and nature has an ingenious way of taking care of it. Plants! Of course, it's not carbon monoxide, it's carbon dioxide.
Yes.
The Christian's responsibility is not to nature, but to the Creator. That's the perspective. And then science is not to be trusted. Many conservative evangelicals, this reporter says, dismiss science as part of the liberal agenda. And Ann Coulter, who is disgusting, says, our book is Genesis. Their book is Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the original environmental hoax. Carson brainwashed an entire generation into imagining a world without birds killed by DDT. Birds are like rats. You couldn't get rid of them if you tried. So, interesting perspectives. So some people aren't on the bandwagon here with nature study and so on, but anyway. Okay, quick summary here. I've gone over time, I'm sorry about that. I don't think I'll spend a lot of time. Basically, I just want to say that Ellen White has been a strong influence on us, I think. Tremendous influence on the nature, our interest in nature. She's promoted that from a number of perspectives. This has resulted in, I think, an impact on the wider culture, the broader culture, by Adventist people. I think our interest as Adventists grew up in a context of the health reform movement, the transcendentalist movement, nature study movement, and the science and religion dialogue of the 19th century. And there are, of course, a few objections to that. I have a vision for the future. I'm going to be now a little more subjective here, if I haven't already been subjective, but here I'm going to be very subjective. And it does concern me when I see our young people and our adults hooked to electronic gadgets. We are driven by electronics today. You walk around campus, people are not plugged into what's around them. They're listening to something. And I just heard a figure the other day, the average child watches television for 5 hours a day. The average child, some children watch it 12, 13 hours a day. And I don't have a TV, but I have seen them recently, like in motel rooms, and I don't think I'd like to have my children watching what's on there anymore. You don't even have the little sitcoms they used to have, which were kind of, you know, mild and almost harmless, but today there's hardly anything like that. So I think our children are kind of being driven by this electronic gadgetry that we're seeing. And I think someday this is going to turn around. There's going to be a backlash. People will decide that, you know, this has really been a serious problem. Prominent book, Richard Louv, Last Child in the Woods. In the most nature-deprived corners of our world, we can see the rise of what might be called cultural autism. The symptoms, tunneled senses, and feelings of isolation and containment, experience including physical risk, is narrowing to about the size of a cathode ray tube or flat panel, if you prefer. An environmental psychologist, Edward Reed, there is something wrong with a society that spends so much money as well as countless hours of human effort to make the least dregs of processed information available to everyone everywhere, and yet does little or nothing to help us explore the world for ourselves. I would like to see kids back doing this kind of thing. You hardly ever see kids outdoors anymore, enjoying the natural world. This is the vision I have. And the second concern I have is the fact that we have promoted health in an amazingly a good way. We've made very healthy people. We've made very beautiful people. But we've left something out. We have forgotten that there's an environment beyond the human system and that we interact with that system. We are indeed a part of the natural world. I would like to see our health message extend out broadly to that of the environment and to include that as part of what it means to be healthy. We breathe the air that's produced by plants. We drink the water generated for us in the natural world. We are part and parcel of the natural community. We cannot think about ourselves as isolated. And unless we keep our environment healthy, we're not healthy. It's just that simple. So I would like to see Adventism moved more toward a Sabbath rest mentality. I think we have something to really give the rest of the world, a health perspective, a holistic view of life, simplicity and creation care. These, to me, are the things that I think Adventism could share with the world and make it a much better place. Thank you very much. I'm sorry it took so long.
We have a few minutes for some questions. This is quite a wide-ranging subject area, so Art told me beforehand that we will accept questions only from people who make sizable contributions. And if you're like many of us here, you're too poor for that. You have to have seen so many birds in the last...
Yes! I was going to put a bird quiz on this, but I didn't.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a few minutes for questions.
Yes?
I have a question. I haven't been able to notice that when God created the parents of the race, he placed them in a garden, not in a factory.
Yes. Very good.
This is sort of a political question, but it's not a fundamental question.
Yes.
We know from the research that Hernandez and folks have done that Adventists in North America tend to vote in the Republican and quite conservative. And the Republicans are, many of them all, but many are noted for their skepticism, lots of things that global warming
sure.
is. Heard discussion at ER yesterday afternoon that said something like 50% of the new Republican people are elected to Congress are skeptical.
A little louder, please.
I'm sorry, I froze. Anyway, my question is, do you run into that kind of skepticism in Adventist among students and Adventist audience? Yeah. Skepticism about such things as global warming?
Yeah, question about global warming. I'm going to repeat the questions because we want this recorded here. So is there skepticism amongst Adventist students about things like global warming because of the conservative sort of position that many Adventists hold? And I'd say yes, there is. Quite a bit of skepticism. I don't teach environmental science. I do teach general ecology, and we don't get into that very much. But Dennis Woodland does teach that, and I know that he does face that. We have tried for years to start an environmental science program at Andrews University. Dennis has worked very hard, and if you know Dennis, he's got a lot of energy, but he hasn't been able to make that fly. Adventist students simply are not interested in the environment, I think. As you know, a general rule, there are some major exceptions to that. I mean, my talk was a major exception to that, but I think in the broad majority, they're not. Walla Walla also tried to start an environmental science program. They have also had problems. They have it, but it's not going great guns. But we were just at Bates College in New Hampshire, or Maine, I guess it is, yeah, Maine here recently, a few weeks ago, giving talks. And we asked the biology people, you know, how many of your students are, you know, pre-med, and how many of you are sort of just basic biology students? And it was, they said, well, we think about a third are probably, you know, interested in biology, and maybe two-thirds in medicine. We have nothing against medicine at all. But we would like to see a little more interest in sort of natural world. And I'm afraid we just really haven't done a very good job of that. But that's a good question, Gary. Yeah.
Right. One of your pictures made clear the reasons why hats would be necessary. I was wondering why, was there a reason why a hard hat in particular is necessary?
Yes, very practical question. Well, why is a hard hat necessary on a gull colony? And the answer is that gulls like to come down with their feet are knotted up like this, and they come down, and as they swoop down to you, they actually drop their feet down and hit you, coming at you at about 40 miles an hour. Well, a gull foot doesn't look very large, but when it hits you in the back of the head, it feels very big. And they also can scrape you with their bill, and they just zip your head open. And they've done that. I've been knocked to the ground, and you know, I see cartoons, you know, you see stars, you see cartoon characters seeing stars. I've seen stars. I didn't think I could see them. Actually, I saw them after a gull hit me one time.
John Harvey Kellogg was accused of pantheism. I'm wondering now, after having heard you, whether it was just a kind of a nature of mysticism that he might have used some extravagant metaphors or something.
Yeah, I haven't. Oh, yes. Sorry. Question regarding John Harvey Kellogg, and he was accused of pantheism, especially by Ellen White, and wondering if that was. I'm sorry to get the last.
Just maybe an extravagant expression of nature mysticism. Yeah. Ellen White herself.
Yes, just an extravagant expression of this sort of interest in the mystery of nature. I think that is a good comment. You see a lot of that in Ellen White's writing, even. I was surprised as I looked back at some of those things I hadn't read in a while, Steps to Christ, Book Education, and so on, where she is very mystical in her concept of nature. So I don't know, and I haven't read Kellogg, so I can't really say that. My dad actually has Kellogg's book. Actually, it was Kellogg's own book. And it's got his name in it and everything, and he cut out all the statements that Ellen White thought were wrong. And he's got this book, and I hope he doesn't get rid of that. My dad gets rid of things sometimes. He's pastor in Battle Creek, so he got a whole lot of these. Yeah,
Jim, it's amazing how your talk indicates how we're products of our past and our environment. You grew up with a father who's a pastor.
Yes.
In the city most of the time.
Yes.
I grew up stepping out of the backyard into 2 million acres of wilderness.
Yes.
my heroes were trappers and hunters and cattlemen. At a church social, we were probably most likely to discuss while we were eating venison and fried chicken, whether or not we would be willing to forego translation rather than being raised from the dead and be vegetarian. Bill Ross, who was an Adventist in Wyoming, was noted for having trapped more coyotes in 1 year than any man alive. He made his living doing that. But he once told me when I was a boy that he didn't want the coyotes to disappear. He says, there's as much of my life as coming to church on Sabbath is. Now, the result of this is that I've been interested in birds, but mostly in predators. And Adventists,
I can believe that, Joe.
Yeah. you mentioned the bald eagle here. You can tell us a lot about the bald eagle and the seagulls, I'm sure. But I write a lot of letters for environmental groups in protection of bears and wolves and eagles and that kind of thing. While probably most of the audience here is more interested in the fall or the spring warblers, right, you know, that they see at the bird feeders and so forth.
Right.
So you're a product of your environment, and I'm a product of mine, but I think at this point in life we've probably merged into the same kind of mystical attitude towards that spirit of life that we find in all of nature.
Yes.
And so it tells us something about how divergency can result in some type of unity.
Yes, yes. I don't think I want to try to repeat that. That was an excellent comment. I resonate with that. Yeah.
Your last slide there is very interesting to me. I'm first of all a Christian, but why am I not a Methodist or a Lutheran? Well, I'm an enthusiastic Adventist because of what you have on that slide. And when I think about it, I think that the way in which our church has impacted culture the most, at least in North America, is on that slide. And I think that the unique, you know, it's not the meeting of the daily or even the investigative judgment, how important that might be. That's not what's impacted culture from our church. It's this. And I think the unique, fabulous heritage we have to share with the culture around us is on that slide. I'm incredibly passionately enthusiastic about that slide. That's beautiful.
Thank you. That was not a paid announcement. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I noticed when you had several pictures of younger Adventists who've gone through in these areas and they've made big contributions and are making contributions. I know several of them, well, some of those, and I know they're no longer Adventists. I'm wondering if you have an idea how many of these young people we lose and why and what we could do to keep them. Maybe Chantel's comments would be a little of a hint to that. But I know a lot of it is science and religion issues, but some of them can't square.
Well, I think that's very, very perceptive, Madeline. Question is, how many of the young people who were involved in nature activities and now have gone on to, you know, rather big positions in sort of the secular world, how many of those have left the church? And I don't know every one of those individuals that I showed up there, and I don't know what their commitments are in every case, but I would say that a fair proportion of them have left Adventism. That doesn't mean to say they've left, you know, a spiritual perspective or something like that, but a lot of them have, those that have gone on to sort of bigger things.
Reason why,
I don't know. I suppose there's as many reasons as there are people, I'll tell you one reason I think it could be a problem. One of the things I didn't say in the talk was I think that, this may sound like an oxymoron, but Adventists are commonly driven by mediocrity. They don't think they can do better. They don't think that they could ever, you know, make a big contribution. contribution. We think we should be persecuted. If we do too well, there might be something wrong. Mm. The devil's after us. Mm. You know, that's just one. I don't know if that's right, mm. but I think, as I think about the, you know, fact that we haven't set up endowment funds for the Adventist schools, things like that, I wonder if maybe we just have not thought big enough. Somebody may counter that, but that's my own perspective. David.
You alluded to the importance of Sabbath keeping and Adventist interest in nature.
Yes.
Sabbath taboos are, at least the American way of keeping the Sabbath, I think has a huge part to do in it. Growing up, TV was, you know, you didn't watch TV, not even nature programs. You didn't read any magazines unless they were about nature. There was nothing else to do but nature. There was a Sabbath afternoon walk.
That's really true. Yeah.
And I'm sure that plays a huge role in starting a lot of kids into nature. Just our Sabbath traditions, our Sabbath taboos. In my experience, that was very true.
Yeah, I think that's a very positive thing. You know, I think there's a lot of positive you've said about this. Yeah. Carol.
Have you had any sense of the impact of other conservative Christian groups compared with, say, Adventist background?
Okay, the question is have I had any experience looking at other Christian groups in relationship to their interest in nature? Is that basically what you're...
And conservation.
No, I haven't. It's a good question, I think, but I really am not aware of anything. Yeah, that's a good, really good question. Yes?
I could actually try and respond
to
that question.
Yes.
Because I worked on a conservation corps
exactly.
the year before last, and the majority of my coworkers on the conservation corps were either atheists or former Christians. I didn't meet any coworkers there who were interested in talking about any sort of religious faith that they had. Mm. So, in my experience, it's been mostly atheists. Mm. Mm.
Interesting. I think some of those folks feel a loss, frankly. And I think the other thing is, I work with paleontologists too, and they're, you know, a mixture of perspectives, but I have a couple friends, and I was just out working with them here just a few weeks ago, and one of them asked, are you a Seventh-day Adventist, knowing that I taught here? I said, yes, I am. And she had told me before, she said, well, I'm not really a Christian. I grew up sort of a nominal Episcopalian, but I just don't see any need for it. And yet she is very, very nice and very accepting of my own perspective. So I think a lot of these people, they like you, they want to, you know, there's no problem, in other words, accepting you, but their own perspective may be shifted. Yeah, that's right. Yes?
I'd like to also speak to that.
Yes.
I think the latest Audubon magazine had a big article about Christian colleges and Christian youth going on to the green track and the conservation track.
Yes.
And they've had some of the same, faced some of the objections you mentioned under your objections, including Calvin College up the road. And when I read that, and I thought, where's the Andrews University in this? Mm-hmm. And a few months ago, Sierra magazine had an article about the colleges that are growing green. In fact, this is the second year that they had a competition or a listing of the greenest colleges in the country, including some of them as a conservative. And again, I wonder where Andrews was, particularly since, as Dave mentioned, many of us grew up with our Sabbath afternoon walks at one of the stations.
Yes, yes.
Mentioned. So it disappoints me that you said it's hard to get an ecology or environmental building.
Yes, very. Thank you for your comment. Comment about the fact that many Christian organizations and colleges in particular are going green, and where's Andrews University in all this? We tried for many years, and I have to say I haven't been involved as much as I should be, but I know a number of us got together probably 10, 15 years ago and tried to get recycling going on campus, And that sort of went for a while until the student that was kind of pushing it left, and you know, it petered out, and now we're doing more of it, and I'm glad to see that. I think we're kind of moving a little bit in that direction, and I'm happy to see that. On our webpage, we have a little thing that says Beyond Plastics, and we do quite a bit of recycling on campus. I'm really happy to see that. And again, Dennis Woodland has been really promoting that strongly, and I appreciate that a lot. But yeah, we could do a lot more. It'd be wonderful if we had a sign up front and said, you know, Andrews University believes in, you know, protecting the creation. You know, what a wonderful way to. Yes. Yes.
Can you touch on the theological and cultural attitudes about the second coming?
Yes.
So intrinsic in our yes. Religious way of life. How do we reconcile that with the need for conservation now in the present?
Okay. That's yeah. The question was, how do we reconcile our belief in the second coming with sort of a emphasis on recycling and an environmental type movement?
I'll help you with this.
Yeah, please. Go ahead. Yeah.
Hal James, I think, has the best line on this. You don't deserve the better world if you haven't taken care of the present.
Yeah, that's what I tell my students, the same type of thing. But I think, I look at the natural world, number one, I'm part of it. So if I take care of myself, I should be taking care of what's around me. That's number one. Number two, I look at life as a gift from God. And if I don't treat that life right, then there's something wrong with the way I'm behaving. And so regardless of when Jesus comes, regardless of what happens in our life, if I only have another year to live, what have you, I should take care of what God has given me. And that includes the broader environmental context. So to me, that's very important, fundamental. We as Adventists who believe in creation and God as creator should be the top of the environmental movement, it seems to me.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
God is very strong.
Yes, God is expecting our stewardship. That's correct. I think that's right. Yes.
You started out with the comparison of your scientific writing versus the spiritual.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have any feelings that you could sum up quickly on how your spiritual side either guides or limits or is an expression of your scientific side of vice versa.
That's a really interesting question.
Because, you know, obviously they're related in some way.
Yeah.
In you.
Yeah.
Science is also governed by funds and, you know, what people are interested in.
Yeah. Question regarding how the sort of spiritual side of my interest in nature relates to the more scientific side and how they interrelate. Boy, that's a really good question. I really should think about that more, but let me just see if I can give you something off the top of my head. Well, first of all, I think I wouldn't have been interested in either one if I hadn't grown up in an environment where nature was sort of promoted by the church, by my family, and so on. So in that sense, I guess the spiritual has sort of influenced my science. I suppose, picked certain scientific topics to look into because of my interest in Christianity and Christian influence. For example, animal behavior is an area that I've done a lot in, and Adventists are very involved in behavior, right? And so I'm interested in why people do what they do. You know? And so that's influenced that. I'm interested in paleontology, and I've done a lot in that area. And again, that's been informed somewhat by my interest in history of life and how the world has come to where we are today, and trying to understand that in relationship to my faith. So some of my religious viewpoints, I guess, have fed into questions that I've developed in my science. And then my science, I suppose, feeds back into my spiritual life to a certain degree. I don't let science control my spiritual life. My spiritual life is too important for that. If I were to, rank, the two, my spiritual values would be number one, and then the science. So that's a, I don't know. I'm not doing a very good job, but that's kind of how I feel about it. Yes. Yes, Walter.
This will be our last question.
Okay.
Buried in Genesis 1, verses 28 and 29, when God created the turns of the race, he entrusted them with dominion over their world and its creatures. This pretty surely was not to be a exploiting, ravaging, polluting lordship, but a rational, benevolent stewardship. And secondly, we may be inclined to feel that Adam was created before he was given his companion. He was given the ecological task of naming the animals. The purpose of his naming the animals was pretty surely not related to ecology. It was a way of preparing him to accept Eve when she would be dropped into his lap. Well, the Creator would not want them to wander off to different parts of the garden and never see each other. So he prepared Adam to give Eve a warm, immediate, lasting reception.
Very interesting.
And I would stir up your brains to figure out exactly how this worked out.
Yeah. Oh, can I just say one more thing? Walter, I'm going to ask you a question. Are you a cousin to Ernest Booth?
I was tempted to comment that you had mentioned that Ernest was a real character and that this great greedy ran in the family.
I love it. It's beautiful.
It is true. Ernest and I were our second cousins.
Our second cousins. Okay. Very interesting. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Professor Hayes.